Hello, everyone. It's about time for us to start the second portion of the events today, the dialogue and Q&A session. First, I want to ask, is there anyone who left the ring in the lounge? Not the lounge, the chapel, where the session on Hesychism is happening. A ring was found, but we're not sure if it was there before we got there. A brain? Did anyone lose the brain? Just the grasping cognitive part of it. Well, come on up, y'all. There's one group, obviously, that I did not think when I made my announcements early this morning, and that is our meditation instructors. Please show me right now by giving them a big round of applause. You can come on up now. Is everyone here? I'm going to read their bios that we printed in the program as a means of introducing them, but I'm thinking it would be really nice if you didn't mind introduce yourselves. Would you be willing to do that for us? And you kind of have to share three mics per table. First, Kathy Bearden.
Today, through my own practice of centering prayer of the last 18 years, I'm a seeker. I'm a human being who has experienced the whole realm of humanness. I bring together backgrounds in nursing, counseling, and spiritual direction in my work at the Des Moines Pastoral Counseling Center. Love teaching, centering prayer.
Thank you, Kathy. Charlie Day?
Yes, I'm Charlie Day, and I started the Des Moines Meditation Group, which meets every Tuesday evening at the Grand Meeting Hall on 42nd Grand, and you all are invited to come every Tuesday at 7:30. We started that when I returned to Des Moines, California in 1994. We did at that time. So it's 20 years. And it's then I started teaching, because all my friends here in Des Moines, where I was raised, knew that I was studying all these voodoo techniques in California. They wanted to learn some.
Thank you, Charlie. Betty Krueger.
I'm Betty Krueger. I have been volunteering with the Art of Living Foundation and the International Association for Human Values for the past 20 years. That's about all I really have to say. I've written a book about it. Some of my experiences. I don't have a whole lot of credentials. I would like to ask, if anybody who came to one of my sessions get a sheet of paper that did not begin with a few notes about Pratyahara. If so, those are my notes for my part of the talk today. Otherwise, I have to wing it.
Thank you, Betty. Father Silwan? Yes.
I'm Father Silwan. I am a Rastafari monk of the Eastern Orthodox Church. Actually, I belong to the Russian Orthodox. I also have Serbian Orthodox Church is now the same thing as.
Thank you, Father Simmons. Dr. Prasad Palakrithi.
My name is Prasad Palakrithi. I'm a cardiologist by profession. I work with Unity Mind Health. I work at Methodist and Lutheran Hospitals. I have to make a confession here. You know, being a church, I want to make a confession. I'm the least experienced of all this elite group of people. And I have two of my teachers are sitting by my side. Betty Kruger, she taught me the Sahaja Samadhi meditation. And Charlie Day, he taught me Buddhist mindfulness meditation. I'm interested in meditation and yoga for a number of years. So we were involved in a lot of other activities, learning yoga, learning pranayama, and all those things. So just I, as a part of this one, we are doing some of these teachings, or teaching yoga and meditation in the temple as well as other places, just as a service. So that's where we are. Thank you.
So, Ido Esty.
Yes, thank you all for letting me come here today. It's really interesting to try to say very much for 25 minutes. Yes, my name is Ido Esty. I'm a song that preached a lot. I'm a monk at the monastery where they serve them. They're practicing over there. So I'm from Japan. So I kept the monastery going. And again, service at the priest of the monks and centers.
Thank you. We prepared some questions for them to answer. And initially, we were thinking that all six of them would answer all three questions, and then we realized how much time that would take. And I'm sure you have plenty of questions that you'd like to ask too. So in the interest of time, I've asked two of them to answer each of the three questions that I prepared. And in rough brushstrokes, one of them concerns the kind of rootedness of these meditative practices in religious traditions and to what extent they're exportable. One concerns the similarities and differences between these meditative practices in the States. And the third one concerns the theme of the comparison project last year and this year, that is the limits of language with respect to speaking about what's going on in these meditative states. So I'm going to ask the first question, I believe, of Father Silwan. And is that, am I right about that?
Yes.
And Charlie Day. Because I think this would be a good one for you, Charlie. And because you never told me which one you're going to answer. This question reads, each of these meditation practices has its origins in a living religious tradition. To what extent does your meditation practice only make sense and achieve its full effect within that religious tradition? Father Sinwa's prepared something so we can... And I think you're all going to really have to get up on the mic so that they can hear you in the hall. Okay.
Hesychasm is a spiritual practice that is intrinsically connected to our to the Orthodox doctrine of salvation, or just soteriology. And so. Although, in hesychasm, as I pointed out in my representation is in Israel is derived from the word isigia, which means silence or stillness, particularly silence and stillness, inner silence and stillness in the presence of God, to have an experiential, the purpose of which is to have an experiential relationship with God. It gets a little problematic to say that one is practicing hesychasm outside of the context of Orthodox life and worship, because the Eastern Orthodox concept, doctrine of salvation, is fundamentally different from that of the Christian West. And so what we hope to accomplish in hesychasm Having said that, though, we have an awful lot of noise around us. Crying children, construction across the street, traffic, and people arguing around us, and just the noise that we create in our own minds. And so the practice of silence and stillness in the presence of the divine is an extremely important endeavor. Something that can and should be done by all people. But to call that hesychasm would be a little bit, it really wouldn't be, that wouldn't be hesychasm outside of the Orthodox understanding of what we're doing, which is part of the process of salvation, that all theosis will become like God. As I understand in the Christian West, human beings can't be like, whereas that is a pretty fundamental Orthodox understanding of what our salvation is about, what our purpose is to be one more like. And the other thing is that hesychasm is normally practiced within the living tradition of the church. One person who is called hesychasm assume that person is practicing Orthodox Christian good standing, is partaking regularly of the life of the church and the sacraments of the church. And so it's sort of a whole bundle of things that go together. You can't just sort of rip out a particular meditation practice in hesychasm and say that somebody who's not Orthodox is practicing. Practice of silence and stillness before God and the use of the Jesus Prayer, which is central to hesychasm, where Jesus Christ, Son of God, have mercy on me, sinner, certainly is used by many Christians in a variety of traditions in the West. So,
thank you. Franny and Zui come to mind for me. Maybe someone in the audience wants to ask a question about that later. Do you know Salinger's Franny and Zooey? Yeah, the book, the novel by J.D. Salinger. Okay. Thank you. Charlie?
Yeah, the word in Buddhism, which is, I studied Buddhist philosophy, though I learned TM, which is basically Hindu rooted philosophy, when I started practicing, and 20 years later started taking retreats at the Buddhist masters. Then that I decided Buddhist philosophy was a living philosophy, a great philosophy of life itself, and have since been studying, practicing, and teaching Buddhist philosophy in addition to meditation. And as I say, salvation would be the word in Christianity. And by the way, having studied Buddhist philosophy, I have a much better appreciation. So, as you begin to study all these traditions, they somehow seem to merge at the top level of the teachings. We have a website, DesMoinesMeditation.org, I've enjoyed writing a lot of papers related to different topics, and Buddhism and other kinds of spiritual topics. And I welcome any of you who are interested to read those papers. They're on DesMoinesMeditation.org. I failed to mention, I also teach a meditation group at the women's prison, and any meditation, any technique of meditation, they really do benefit and notice the results. Some of them don't notice it quite as dramatically as they do, but those who meditate regularly and have participated in my prison group do report being sent to the hole less often, getting in trouble less often, getting the jobs they would like, the assignments they would like, the housing units they would like. And it's just a general reflection, if you think about it. Their behavior improves. They're much more likely to act out on the irritation, the guilt, the sadness that they might otherwise act out on and get in trouble. So their behavior vastly improves, so they become a very rewarding group for the benefits of the scientific meditation. Thank you.
Thanks, Jeremy. So the second question concerns similarities and differences between meditative practices and states. Betty and Prasad will be answering this, and the question formally goes like this. It has been said that all meditation practices are essentially the same, or that all meditation practices yield similar experiences or states or produce similar results. Do you find this to be true? What to you are the important similarities or differences between different meditative practices? Maybe,
okay, with your thoughts. First of all, I would agree there is something universal about the meditative experience, and I would even go so far as to say that there is something essentially the same about the ultimate goal of all meditations. It might be called by different names in different traditions, but, you know, Rose Lee, any other name, it's not the same. On the other hand, I do find that different practices confer, importantly, different values. I teach through the Art of Living Foundation, as you know, and we explore through many ways of meditation. You kind of divide those into five basic areas: through the body, through the breath, through the five senses, through emotion, and through intellect. Through the body, yoga asanas, we use those a lot. Yoga asanas can lead into a meditative state. Also, they can be used to prepare one for another meditation. Other examples might be Tai Chi and various martial arts. Physical practices have certain characteristic advantages. They tend to confer balance, flexibility, energy flow in the body, health and longevity, and so forth. Now, with the breath, Art of Living uses a lot of breathing practices. Breathing practices energize, oxygenate, detoxify, and generally enliven the system. Breath also serves as an interface between mind and body. Every emotion or mental activity will be supported by a characteristic rhythm of breath. Because of this, breath is a very valuable tool for handling the mind. If you were to enroll in the Art of Living Happiness program, you will learn a sequence of breathing practices that lead you into a meditative state, and that also have been used to successfully address certain kinds of mental health issues, like PTSD and depression. So number three would be the five senses. You know, Chinese gongs, Gregorian chants, a relaxing touch therapy, the fragrance of incense. There's so many ways that the senses can externally aid or lead us into a meditative state. These are used extensively in most traditions, actually. There are also internal ways of using the sensory experience. In certain traditional practices that we use in Art of Living, these are very much drawn upon. When during the Pratyahara meditations, and then you might remember there was an instruction to, with your eyes closed, bring your awareness to the top of your head. And what happens is you feel the top of your head inside your mind. Or you might, in some meditation, be said to bring into your awareness a huge mountain. With your eyes closed, you see a mountain
inside. That's using an internal sensory thing. In the Sahaj Samadhi meditation that we teach through Art of Living, we use a sound in a very inward way. The sound is called a mantra. And you're trained to pick up just a very faint impulse inside your mind, like the feeling of the thought of a sound. It's very, very subtle. Sound is actually considered to be the most subtle of all the five senses. And for that reason, internal mantra type of meditation has a tendency to take you deeper, faster than many other types of practice. It's also a very self-sufficient approach. You don't need any kind of CD or external aid. You can sit and meditate anywhere, literally. So that's why we actually highly recommend that particular practice, along with all the other practices that we introduce to people. Number four, emotion. At the height of any emotion, we can be drawn into a meditative state. Most important of these, I would say, for our purposes, would be the height of emotion, the ecstatic experience of devotional love. Traditionally, this is called bhakti. Bhakti itself is not actually a practice, it's a happening. Bhakti often does happen, and quite powerfully, as a kind of further development of meditation, because the mind and body experience so much gratitude and bliss, and you just love it so much, that you can't help but be transported, particularly with regular practice, into a very great level of enthusiasm for it, kind of a very strong feeling of emotional love there. Now, love is one of the most, is probably the most powerful force in the universe, and it is considered that if you get caught up into a wave of bhakti or devotional love, that that puts you on a kind of fast track toward that ultimate goal of self-realization or enlightenment. But love also tends to make us feel very vulnerable, and if that's not handled wisely, it can tend to distort into forms of fear and pull us back a bit. So in the Art of Living programs, we recommend certain sort of sturdy virtues to support that kind of experience and to stabilize it. The virtues would be dedication, commitment, and service. I mentioned too many of you, the Art of Living does a lot of service. That's part of the reason why these practices stabilize and they stabilize and give some structure to the very powerful experience of devotional love that can come up through practice. And then number five would be through the intellect. We all know that we study deeply into some area, we can just become overwhelmed with the complexity and the beauty of natural phenomena or the vastness of the universe. And that takes us into a state of wonder, which is very akin to meditation. People who pursue ardently some realm of knowledge often become deeply attuned in almost a meditative or a very meditative way with the natural law. The insights and understandings just come to them. You often find that almost directly referred to in the stories of people like Albert Einstein or Stephen Hawking. So those are the five things. And in conclusion, I would just like to recommend that those of you who are pursuing meditation, and as you get more interested in orienting to the ultimate goals of self-realization or enlightenment or whatever you want to call it, that you expedite your progress by taking advice that helps, some guidance from a master or a living tradition, and or a living tradition. And those of you who have taken a look at my book will probably not be surprised to hear me say that. And that's all I have to say.
Thank you, Betty.
I agree with most of the what you have been saying. What I feel, I'm familiar with three of the meditation practices. I practice Sahaja Samadhi as well as Buddhist mindfulness meditation as well as Kundalini meditation. These are the very familiar. Unfortunately, I didn't have the opportunity to be involved in other meditative practices. What I feel is, finally, when you look at these meditative practices, what the final goal is self-realization and spiritual enlightenment. That is the goal of this one. How we are going to achieve that may be slightly different, maybe slightly, you know, some may have a circuitous pathways, some may have a straight pathways, so it depends on which way you want to take, you know. But in order to do achieve a lot of this, say for example, if we are talking about Kundalini Yoga, which is a, you know, not only the meditation, but it is also aided by yogic asanas or postures and breathing techniques. As Betty mentioned, breathing techniques are very important, you know, to make your mind, you know, conducive for, you know, the next goal, that is our goal of spiritual enlightenment. All these things will help us, you know, in going to the next stage and achieving, you know, realizing the individual divinity and the oneness with the, you know, supreme creation. So that is our goal. So in order to get that, we have to have all these things, other things like, you know, breathing techniques and in addition to meditative technique, those and physical activity like asanas or postures, they would be very helpful to achieve this.
Thank you. Our third and final question concerns the sixth syllable word, M-F-A-B-I-L-I-T. Reverend S.P. and Kathy Reardon will be answering this one, and it goes as follows. The theme of the comparison project for this year and last year is ineffability, the limits of language, or words, and religion. To what extent does your meditation practice yield a state or experience that transcends or resists concepts and words? What accounts for its ineffability? And now you say nothing. I don't know who wants to go first.
Go ahead. I find it such a paradox. So my practice is centering prayer, and it's a Christian prayer of silence. We learn everything we need to through the practice of the prayer. There are hundreds of books written about centering prayer. There are hundreds of conversations going on about centering prayer and all these other meditation practices. Words, 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 words. For something that's essentially silent and without form, without it's beyond thought, beyond emotions, beyond concepts. What happens in that silence? Mystery. Mystery. So one of the things I find very intriguing and paradoxical, ambiguous, is that in the first part of our lives, in this society, for all kinds of reasons, we develop a self. And that happens in the family, and it happens in society. So that self helps to accomplish a certain number of things, to have that kind of development. In the second half of life, we're usually invited to let go of that self. So there it is. There's the work, the spiritual journey. And in the Christian tradition, that's called kenosis, emptying, emptying. And centering prayer is a form of meditation that is completely receptive. So there are forms of Christian meditation that are what we call concentrative, in that we're using something like the breath, we're focusing on the breath, or we're focusing on a word or phrase mantrically. But centering prayer is not concentrative, it is receptive. And so that means there's some guidelines, but there's really no real rules for it. And so it is a practice, first and foremost, in surrendering. And what are we surrendering to? If there's any purpose in centering prayer, the primary purpose is developing our relationship with the living Christ, God. And how do we do that? We surrender the self that gets in the way of that. Centering prayer teaches us to let go of our thinking, which in this Western culture particularly defines ourselves, and we get very attached to ourselves and who we think we are. And so in learning how to let go of our thoughts, it is this practice of self-emptying so that there is this space beyond words, concepts, and feelings, in which that divine presence or healing or whatever we want to call it is at work. So we cooperate with that process by using a sacred word that we're not using mantrically, but we're using it as we need to so that we can let go of engagement with thoughts. Our brains think. So often, you know, I have people say, I can't clear my mind. You're not supposed to clear your mind. Our minds, it's very hard to clear them because they're thinking all the time. But sometimes that may happen spontaneously in the course of the prayer time. But we can learn how to let go of our thoughts, because letting go is such an important spiritual practice. And I very much agree with so much that has been said at this table, especially for what Charlie shared about there's not cause and effect in centering prayer. It's faithfulness to the practice that brings about things like this, more of a sense of centeredness and groundness. This ability to be less reactive is a huge thing. We have so much reactivity in our world, and it is the source of no end of problems. And so to receive this kind of inward help with becoming centered, grounded individuals who can listen deeply, another very necessary thing in the world. Let's see, what else do I want to get in here? Ultimately, whatever happens to us in whatever our practice is meant to be taken into the world. So there is this convergence or working together of contemplation, meditation, and action or service to life, however that comes in the unique ways that we're called that. So I had the good fortune of being able to get my thoughts together while the rest of these people were talking today, which I really appreciated, because when Tim pushed the microphone in front of me with the introductions, I forgot to say that there is an organization called Contemplative Outreach in Central Iowa here. The website is Center Iowa. And over at that table, there is a sheet with the activities that we offer during the course of the year. And we also have centering prayer groups throughout Des Moines, too. It can be very useful to practice with others. And also, there's a link on that website to Contemplative Outreach Limited, which is the international organization that has a plethora of information on this practice as well.
Thank you, Kathy. Reverend Espy?
I can appreciate what Kathy said, but I haven't had time to actually think about this. I did question myself the last few days. What was I thinking, choosing this question, trying to talk about something about beyond the words? So then I thought, well, I'm the third question, so these people keep talking long enough, and maybe I'll get out of time. And I gotta say, I'm a little disappointed in some of that time, so I have to say something. First of all, I'm going to preface by saying that Buddhist practice is it's a way of life. Meditation is an aspect, a very important aspect of the practice. But it's suddenly included within the manner of practice. But that being said, historically, the Buddha and all people consider ancestors. Years have talked about awakening, or another way to say it is knowing what. And that knowing is subtle and inconceivable. And it is really about going to the depths of our existence. Depth of our existence, the place where we awaken to the fact that there's no gap between any of the children. Suddenly, here, all of our lives are in this world where you're much bigger. There's one sense you're much bigger, but also you're dynamic there. Something that's cannot be understood by the spirit of thinking. It's not something you can grasp by the spirit of mind. It's something that's experiential. Talking about we'll sometimes talk about everybody comes to people come to me and say, well, I've read a lot of books. And that part of the philosophical aspect is really certainly in Buddhism, a lot of people are fascinated with the philosophy of the presence of the flexibility. The response to that is that's all well and good, but you can't eat the baby. Needs to be engaged. You can read, you can depend on words, you can get caught in phrases, you're all one. There's a whole bunch of cards and things, but they're just words. Following after speech is not it's missing the word. So another analogy, I guess, is trying to. How do you describe chocolate? It's chocolate. It's an experiential taste. So I think we all, when I listen to the rest of the panel, I find that the differences in our approach are in the words, not in the differences. But I can probably get into discussions.
Y'all to ask some questions. While you're thinking of what you want to ask, though, I'd like to say three things, just in case we go over and I don't have a chance to say them. First of all, this is the first time we've done this. It's pretty awesome, huh? Yeah. But as all things, not without its issues, I'm thinking this is something we'll want to do again, and I'd love to have feedback about what worked and what didn't work. We almost had a Muslim, a Sufi, to teach a session. We almost had a session on Jewish meditation. We almost had a session on Sikh meditation. And I'd love to see more diversity, even more diversity in the future. We've got some issues to work out, maybe with the rooms and all that. But I'd love to hear from you about what worked and didn't. And there are evaluation forms, again, from Humanities Iowa out there that will give them feedback about what we're doing. And we'll see that as well, and that will give us feedback about what we're doing. As Kathy mentioned, there's literature from representing these meditative practices and communities in the back, help yourselves, except for the stuff that has prices on it that you have to buy. And finally, we'll do two lectures this semester, one a week from this Thursday on Zen Buddhism and language, and another one 3 weeks after that on the Hindu philosophy of Advaita Vedanta and language. All that's on our brochure. We're gonna end up this semester with an ineffability and art exhibition on Drake's campus that will involve visual representations, poetry readings, and music. That should be quite a trip. Okay, that's all that I needed to say. And now I can come find you with the mic if you have a question, or if you can project, we can go without the mic.
need a mic.
All right.
I heard, I think it's Becky saying that organization for human values. I think, what is human values?
What are the human values? What do we all value? Love, peace, justice, service. Human values refers to all the things that we all want. That's what the word value means. So I'm sure that that's exactly what the choice of that term for the International Association for Human Values was thinking about. Things that are common to all of the major spiritual and cultural traditions. The Art Living Foundation and IAHV actually run programs in a lot of different cultural contexts, so we look for common ground a very great deal. The IAHV in particular focuses upon institution teaching through institutional settings such as prisons and also corporations and hospital programs, also for distressed populations, humanitarian efforts especially. So does that answer your question?
My question is about how meditation can help about healing some sickness. I don't know, I would like to ask particular allergies or things like that. I don't know if there is any relation. We have a doctor on the
and a nurse. My response to that is so many of the health conditions we deal with today are stress related. And so whatever helps to settle the system is going to be supportive of overall health and well-being. I think healing and cure are very different terms. And so healing can be part of management of something that can't be cured, but there is an optimal degree of health for. So we know from many of these practices, research has shown that it induces a relaxation response, which has deep benefits for the body in a number of ways, but not just the body, also for our psychological and spiritual health as well.
Regarding the allergy and the treatment, I mean, some of the breathing practices, breathing techniques, are definitely going to help people with these conditions. Actually, last week, one of our friends, he went out of country, and he learned a breathing technique. I mean, those are all well-defined techniques, nothing normal about it. Or, he was saying, he has problem with, allergies. And, he was having always sneezing, in the morning, and, every time it's becoming a big problem. And he was taking the medications for a long time. This is going on many years, it seems. And once he started practicing this breathing technique for a few months, now he has become completely free of the problem. So some of them, I think, can be, cured by some of these techniques, by some of these practices, either breathing practices or some of the special type of asanas or some of the meditative practices can help tremendously. And it's a very well-defined literature in the literature that, many conditions like hypertension, high blood pressure, people who have high blood pressure, if they go for meditative practices, I'm not saying which meditation, but meditative practices, their blood pressure comes down. They go off of the medication. And like that, there are so many conditions are being treated, And recently, actually, one of the irregular heart rhythm, what we call it as atrial fibrillation, it's a very, very common condition. As we get older, people who are in 60s and 70s have this problem with atrial fibrillation very, very frequently. This is one of the common conditions which we see in our practice day to day. So, you know, they did a study. What they did is they took the patients who have this problem and divided it into two groups. One group, they have regular meditative sessions, you know, on a regular basis, and the other group, where they were being treated conventionally. When they followed these patients, you know, what happened is ultimately the people who received the meditative practices, there is much decreased incidence of atrial fibrillation and symptoms. Like that, so many conditions, you know, I mean, cognitive abilities, they can improve with meditative practices. So those are all so many conditions that can be treated, and even the Western literature, you know, previously it was mostly confined to the Eastern practice of medicine, but now alternate medicine has become so popular even in the Western, even in this country, and a lot of these things are being done without medicines. So many conditions can be treated by that.
Thank you all for coming and giving us these wonderful sessions. My question is a follow-up to what she said earlier, her question. How do you weed out what's not necessary, all the words, and just jump in to get started and practice something that can help you eventually? That's to any of you that want to answer that.
While sitting down, while laying in bed, just turn your attention to the breath as you want and see how it can turn it there. Literally, no matter what everybody's saying, I agree with it. It's a question of calming the mind. And meditation is the researched, well researched now, 50 years ago, people meditated. People had done it for thousands of years, but there wasn't the research that exists now that shows an exceedingly beneficial practice, medically, neurologically, psychologically, occupationally, relationship-wise, career-wise. So, but don't think you have to do that 40 minutes a day, twice a day. You can do it for 2 minutes, you can do it for 10 minutes, you can do it. But if you're going to do it while driving the car or walking, keep your eyes open.
My mic? I thought that was feedback, but it's just
I'm sure I'm not alone in the room when I say I've experienced my life, my own battles, and watched my loved ones experience the battles with depression. Conditions like receptor and heart conditions, like blood pressure. All of this falls under this umbrella of treated by meditation, but I don't understand why it's not really brought in the Zen as a valid practice. We prescribe medications, don't know what to do. I'm sure that no one has ever died from a lethal combination of meditations. So I'm just kind of wondering to myself, and I don't know how you can answer this, but why has this stayed separate for so long, other than it's been tied to religions from what we consider our modern medical Western practice? We hand out pills that we don't know before we suggest this.
Just hitting that up, they have tried to introduce meditation in school systems. They got into trouble calling it that, so they called it relaxation and tried to introduce it as a secular and non-religious method. But there were a lot of complaints even about that. That there was an effort to teach religion by calling it something else. So there's a lot of resistance against introducing these sort of proven methods that facilitate clarity of thinking, learning. You can do something about that. Take it to your school board and school system. Please be my guest.
Yeah, You know, that's a very, very interesting question. Why don't we prescribe alternative medication or non-therapeutic type of practices? Why don't we do that? If you go to a psychiatrist and go with depression, and if they talk about meditation as a treatment, I don't know how many would they go back to that doctor. I mean, you know, I actually see this, you know, in my practice very frequently. What happens is we get young ladies who are 20, 21, who have rapid heartbeat, sinus tachycardia. And their hearts, they go rapidly without doing much exercise or anything. So that we label it as inappropriate sinus tachycardia. The problem is, you know, if we prescribe medications, the medications cause problem. A lot of them, they have side effects from the medication, they can't tolerate the medication. And a lot of times, I try to talk to them about doing meditation. You know, actually, so many times I talk to them, you know, but unfortunately, the effect of meditation, it cannot be seen overnight. You cannot get that effect within a matter of few days. It may take weeks, months, years to get that effect. How many people have the patience to do that? That is the other problem. So those are the problems, you know, I mean, those are wonderful, you know, some of the alternate medicine is a great thing, and it can be done without any side effects, without any problems, but the effects are not seen immediately. So most of us want immediate effect. So we don't have the patience to wait for that. So in order to get the benefit from all these type of practices, it takes many, many days and months. So that's a problem I see, at least in my practice.
One of the things that I'm aware of, because I often, with the people I work with, introduce meditation in some form for them to do, and this is very symbolic of our culture, I don't have the time. I don't have the time, which may be more like I don't want to take the time, because we're always making decisions about our time and how we are going to use it. And we're overly attached to certain kinds of things that we want to spend our time with. So that's one of the dilemmas that I find is helping people to look at time as something that we can be in charge of. As it is, for many of us, we feel time has us, we don't have it. The other thing about introducing meditation and the difficulty in school and other systems, I want to say for Seminary Prayer how very hard it is to introduce it into churches.
Well, how do we feel about our time? Do we have time for one more question, or shall we adjourn? This time? For one more?
Ms. Verdon was talking about they don't want to take the time. I also think it's we don't know how to take the time. And when I frame things in that context, it's very helpful for me to become more open, gracious, and accepting of everyone without trying to minimize the judgment when I'm in healthcare and when I see people that have depression. It's in trying to teach them some way to alleviate some of their suffering beyond the medications. It's the resistance is, I think, fear and not knowing how. And that's my role in this, where I work, is to teach them somehow, I guess. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you for sharing so much of your time with us this morning, or Saturday mornings. And join me, please, in thanking once again the professor.